is the second in a series of, the second in this sermon series. And Jordan, last week, if you're watching, you just dropped a bombshell on us. It was both amazing and challenging. Certainly for me it was, anyways. He gave us an example of what dangerous prayers can look like. He laid out four different parts of specifically that dangerous prayer. It searched our hearts. It revealed our fears. It uncovered our sins. And finally, it leads us. The central chapter we focused on last week was Psalm 139. And you should certainly go read it, but one of the main verses that we sat on was, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. Point out anything in me that offends you." Now that entire chapter, is it my thing? Okay, yeah, then it's definitely me. I don't know. Okay, we'll just move on. That entire chapter is dangerous. Is a dangerous prayer written by King David. Actually, most of Psalms is just dangerous prayers. And they're not dangerous necessarily because of what they're saying, but because of the actions they apply. If you look at the end of that last verse, "Test me and know my anxious thoughts. Point out anything in me that offends you." That's some serious. Check. Whoa. Hey, I'm here. I wasn't here. Now I was really here. Now I'm just kind of here. and sorry for any headphone listeners on the stream. I'm sure your ears are bleeding right now. I'm sorry. Technical difficulties. So we go through this house cleaning when we have a dangerous prayer in our life. This house cleaning in our hearts. It won't be easy when you start to pray dangerous prayers. In fact, the consequences may take our entire lives to deal with. One young man that we read about in the Bible starts off his entire career at a young age with a dangerous prayer. His name was Samuel. Now, if you know the story of Samuel, you know that he was a child of a mother who was supposedly barren. And she prayed that if she were to have a child, she would dedicate that child to God. This is what it says in 1 Samuel 1, 9 through 11. "Once, after a sacrifice meal at Shiloh, Hannah got up and went to pray. Eli, the priest, was sitting at the customary place beside the entrance of the tabernacle. Hannah was deep in anguish, crying bitterly as she prayed to the Lord. And she made this vow, 'O Lord of heaven's armies, if you look upon my sorrow and answer my prayer and give me a son, then I will give him back to you. He will be yours for his entire lifetime. And as a sign that he has been dedicated to the Lord, his hair will never be cut.'" And as the story goes on, obviously Samuel is born. And once he reaches an age where he doesn't need his mother anymore, she actually gives him to the high priest Eli as soon as she was able to be raised in the presence of God. Now, there's a couple interesting facts about the life of Samuel and kind of how he grew up. One of them is, while he lived in the temple with Eli, he was not groomed to be a priest. See, you had to be a part of a certain bloodline, the bloodline of Aaron, Moses' brother. And this was the requirement for all priests set in Exodus 40, 12 through 15. Present Aaron and his sons at the entrance of the tabernacle and wash them with water. Dress Aaron with the sacred garments and anoint him. Consecrate him to serve as my priest. Then present his sons and dress them in their tunics. Anoint them as you did their father, so they may also serve me as a priest. With their anointing, Aaron's descendants are set apart for the priesthood forever, from generation to generation. So he couldn't be a priest. That just wasn't in the cards for him. He couldn't be a normal temple worker either. The Levites, who were normally the ones who took care of the temple, were a specific tribe of Israel set apart to take care of the temple. In a similar way that Aaron and his family were called, the Levites were called to do this. You couldn't just volunteer for these jobs like you can today, or feel a call from God and just be a Levite. It's just not how it worked. So within the structure of the temple and the tabernacle, Samuel was sort of an outsider. And on top of that, when we get to the story of Samuel and where we're about to get in the story, no one had heard directly from God in quite a long time, probably about 100 years. The last person to hear from God was a guy named Jephthah, all the way back in the book of Judges. Israel, during these 100 years, didn't really want anything to do with God, so God had removed himself. They had very clearly shown in their leadership and in their citizenship that they were going to do whatever they wanted, however they wanted, regardless of what God had said. And even in Samuel 3:1, we see now in those days, messages from the Lord were very rare, and visions were quite uncommon. So we have Samuel growing up in the temple. He's probably 6, 7, 8, 9, somewhere in there. He's certainly young. And where we're going to be sitting today is 1 Samuel 3, 1 through 10. So if you have your Bibles, the Bible app, whatever, you can go there. It'll certainly be on the overheads, most of our. As we go through this, it seems his job is, one, to stay up with the lamp. So in the tabernacle, there's lots of things, and one of those things is a lamp. And in the evening, as it gets dark, that lamp was lit, and it wasn't supposed to go out. Keeping this lamp lit was a permanent law for the people of Israel, laid out in Exodus 27, 20 through 21. Which means, some Bible translations, when you read 3, 1 through 10, it says he was sleeping. It's not quite right. The actual Hebrew word there is that he's laying. He's laying down. So he's not exactly sleeping because he has to keep this thing lit, or it's going to be a problem. He's going to get in trouble, and it's not going to be great for anyone. So while he's sitting there, probably in total silence, not much is going on, certainly. Many Bible scholars think it's probably 1 to 3 in the morning before dawn. And he hears his name called, Samuel. Natural, a young kid is going to be like, oh, Eli's probably calling me. Let me go over here and, Eli, what's going on? Can you, like, you called me, what's up? Eli's like, why'd you wake me up? It's 3 a.m. Probably like most parents, like, oh, I'm not a parent, so I don't know, but like, oh, I had a bad dream. Go back to bed. It's fine. Don't worry about it. I didn't call you, whatever. Now, Eli was just never called him. But then it happened again. So imagine being in bed, just getting to that point where I'm about to fall asleep, or like that midway point where you're like kind of asleep but kind of awake, and then comes back, hey, you called me. No, I didn't. I'm sleeping, can't you tell? Well, someone called me. This happens 3 times. Samuel gets back up and is like, hey, you called? No, I didn't. And by the 3rd time, it says something interesting in chapter 3, verse 7. Samuel did not yet know the Lord because he had never had a message from the Lord before. So now we know that Samuel is hearing the voice of God. This isn't in his head. This isn't Eli playing a very weird prank on him. This is Samuel hearing the voice of God for the first time. And he doesn't even realize it. How is God going to get through to him? Well, in his groggy state, by the 4th time that Samuel shows up, Eli's like, wait a second. We're in the tabernacle. This kid's literally sleeping next to where the Spirit of God dwells. Maybe it's God. He realizes it's the voice of God speaking to Samuel. He gives these instructions, and this is Samuel 3, 8, and 9. Then Samuel realizes it was the Lord who was calling the boy. So he said to Samuel, go and lie down again. And if someone calls again, say, speak, Lord, your servant is listening. So Samuel went back to bed. Now that Samuel has heard the voice call him 3 times, it seems to sound like Eli calling him. He's given instructions to go back and just wait. And that's a hard place to be, especially in the world we live in, right? To just wait. You don't know what's going on. You don't know, you know, forward, back. Should I stand here? Should I stand over there? Should I walk towards that? No, you just wait. It's a hard place to be in. So, here's the pivotal moment in 1 Samuel 3:10. The Lord came and stood there. He didn't hear me last time. He didn't know it was me. I'm going to be here. Calling as the other times, Samuel, Samuel. Then Samuel said, speak, for your servant is listening. So the stage is set. And what seems like an innocuous prayer at the end of all of this, speak, for your servant is listening. But it's important to know what got us here. What got Samuel to this point where he could say this. It's not just, oh, I heard God, now I'm going to respond. We went all of this over the whole portion of the story for a reason. The first thing to point out was Samuel was sitting in silence and solitude. That's a hard place to be for us today. I know it is for me. This is just taking quiet time, getting out of your environment, your normal environment, and just being someplace with other people or distractions where you and God can meet. This could just be going to the park and sitting on a bench. Could be going off into the woods if you're a hunter. I know a lot of hunters take their quiet time out in the woods. It could be what at least I grew up calling it, a prayer closet, which is just a space in your house where you sit and meet with God that's set aside for this time with God. But specifically, it has to be some place that separates you and puts you in a place where you can both hear and interact with God. Because you're going to bring about some dangerous prayers in your life if you spend time in silence and solitude. It's just going to happen. If you spend that time focused on God, listen, I spend like 15 minutes a day and it changed my life. It's powerful. And we see this place of silence and solitude throughout the Bible. Abraham in Genesis 22, Moses in Exodus 3, Elijah in 1 Kings 19, Jesus several times, but once specifically in Luke 6, and several others. Where they just leave and go to a place by themselves where they can focus totally on God. Samuel was literally feet from the presence of God. He was inside the tabernacle. He was separated from everyone else, was normally, and in a place where he could meet God. This is so important for us. If you're going to pray dangerously, the location is often just as important as the prayer itself. The second part of the story that's important for us to point out is having someone in your life that can speak to you when you're totally missing God's voice. Samuel didn't get it. He thought it was Eli. He probably would have kept thinking it was Eli. Eli wasn't perfect, but he was someone that Samuel could rely on. He was still the high priest, after all. He was still a good man. In 1 Samuel 3, 8, and 9, then Eli perceived that the Lord was calling the boy. Therefore Eli said to Samuel, "Go, lie down, and if he calls you, you shall see. Speak, Lord, for your servant hears." So Samuel went and lay down in his place. For us, this might look like a mentor, an accountability partner, sometimes just your best friend. But it's someone who knows your situation enough to point out that God is talking to you. It's someone that you trust in spiritual things, matters. This happened for me in my call to ministry. I had surrounded myself with people I trusted, and when I was asking the real hard questions, they're like, "Hey, hello, this is God. You should probably take some time and figure it out, because it seems like he's calling you to something. They knew and led me to meet God and his plan. And that's what Eli is doing for Samuel. Having someone like Eli in your life won't let you easily miss the opportunities that God puts in front of you. And finally, we have this core, this dangerous prayer. The prayer seems simple, but it's far from that. It starts out with, speak. Now, if you're like me and you look at that, it's like, well, isn't it a little presumptuous for Samuel to be like, hey, God, talk to me. I'd be like, I'm here, God. No, Samuel starts with speak. This seems commanding, but it's really humbling. Because there was an urgency to God's voice. You see, in the Bible, when we see two words put together at the same, so in this case we have Samuel, Samuel, it's urgency. It's like, hey, hey, something's happening. There goes that music. There's something happening. Remember how I said earlier in Psalm 139, it wasn't because of the words necessarily, but it was because of the actions implied? Well, telling God to speak, asking God to speak, Samuel surrendering himself to God's words. And we know how powerful they are from the creation story. God literally brings about the universe by speaking it. And Samuel is humbling himself to any words that God may speak in that moment. And then at the end of that prayer, we have listening. Now, the Old Testament word for listen is often lost in translation. Because when we think of listening, we think, oh, I'm hearing you, I'm understanding you. But the word for listen in Hebrew often is Shema. And the teens are probably rolling their eyes to some extent because they know this word, and I've pounded this word into their head several times. Shema means to listen and obey. It implies action. When you're listening, you're not just listening to hear and to comprehend. It implies that you're going to fulfill whatever is being spoken to you. These are the essential pieces that make up Samuel's dangerous prayer. There's pretext to our prayers. It's important. The things that make our prayers are important, especially the most dangerous ones in our lives. So let's turn this around. Can you set the stage for your own dangerous prayers? Are you willing to take the time needed away from just the craziness of life to get alone with God and his presence? Are you willing to surround yourself with those who will recognize when God is trying to speak in your life and push you towards God's will? Even when you're completely oblivious to it? Are you willing to answer God's call to you with speak? For your servant is listening. Because when you learn to start off with that kind of dangerous prayer? You'll find that there are many more dangerous prayers along the way, and you start living a dangerous lifestyle for God. If you don't know the whole story of Samuel, I urge you to read it. It's 1 Samuel chapters 1 through 25. There's pieces that are interspersed between there, but he lived a fearless life. We see this first interaction with Samuel, and we see what it causes the rest of his life to look like. He went on to ordain the first and second king of Israel. He lived a fearless life, even up standing up against the mob that wanted a king in the first place, knowing that they could probably kill him. And then, after they got a king, he stood up to that king when he wasn't doing what was right. And kind of under his nose, ordained a new king. See, when you pray dangerously, you live dangerously. Willing to do whatever God asks, no matter how absurd it may seem. If you want a real, living, breathing example of this, that's right now. Some of you probably remember the missionaries we had almost right before all this craziness happened, called the Schlegels. They're a wonderful couple, and if you've been in the prayer after church, you recognize them because they've shown up in that several times too. They're a young family, they've got two kids, and they heard God's call. And have uprooted their lives to go live somewhere else that, quite frankly, is dangerous for them. Now, it doesn't have to be that extreme. Most of us aren't called to be missionaries. I was called to be a pastor, but again, not everyone's called to be a pastor. But we're all called to something. We're all called to some ministry in our lives. God has a call on your life. Speak, for your servant is listening. I'll call the worship team up. Will your story be the one that I tell next time instead of Samuel's? Will you start it with a dangerous prayer? Will you leave this room with a dangerous prayer? Because praying dangerous prayer is telling God that you trust him. Not in the little things, although it includes the little things, but also in the big things. So, will you trust him when your bank account's empty? Will you trust him when you don't know the results of the blood work and it's very scary? Will you trust him when you find out the results of the blood work and it is very scary? Will you trust him when it feels like the world is falling apart around you, like it kind of is right now for all of us? Will you trust him with your kids? Hannah did. Some of the most precious things in our lives and as parents, the most precious things in most of our lives. Will you trust him with them? Because it's not easy. Don't mistake this for being easy. I don't have it all figured out. And that's why we have to live a life of dangerous prayers, because God keeps course correcting us through the whole way. But it leads us to someplace amazing. Praying dangerous prayers means living a dangerous life, which ultimately, in the end, is just trusting God with that life.
Just as I am.